From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, advocates for raising the state's minimum wage rally at the Capitol as there are growing signs there might not be a special session to deal with the issue. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, will share his thoughts on that, and we'll take you to a new wind farm in the North Country. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Advocates for a minimum wage hike rallied at the state capitol this week amid growing signals that there might not be a special session to deal with the issue or any items at all this year. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The rally, organized by churches located near the state capitol as well as statewide religious groups, used words like faith and morals when talking about the connection they see between the growth of people coming to food pantries and the state's stagnant minimum wage. The Reverend Deb Jamison operates a food pantry just one block away from where state lawmakers meet. She says nearly half of her clients have jobs.
And we believe that no one should be trapped in poverty by low wages. If the minimum wage doesn't cover necessities, it's not a minimum wage, it's a minus wage. No matter what job you have, you should not have to choose between eating or heating, childcare or health care.
Outside, around 100 people held signs and chanted on the steps of the Capitol.
Raise the minimum wage!
Raise the minimum wage!
Asking Governor Cuomo and state lawmakers to raise the minimum wage in New York from the current $7.25 an hour to $8.50. The lawmakers are not in Albany and haven't been since last June. There was talk of holding a special session in December where agenda items might include a hike in the minimum wage and an increase in state lawmakers' pay. But Governor Cuomo has been preoccupied with the cleanup after Hurricane Sandy, and the state Senate is in the midst of a potential leadership struggle. Though Republicans are in charge until the end of the year, two November races are still being counted, and there's uncertainty over who might be in control by January. Mark Dunley with Hunger Action Network says the governor could ask the legislature to return to raise the minimum wage without having to deal with any of those other issues.
We can all speculate about the rumors we've all heard about what's going on. If he's concerned that some issues are too complicated for the legislature and may take too much time, the minimum wage, fortunately, is not one of those issues. So we could just do the minimum wage. It should be about a five-minute meeting up, down in the Senate, whether or not to vote for it.
He says polls show 80% of New Yorkers would like to see the minimum wage increased. Rob Smith with Interfaith Impact agrees that a pay raise for state lawmakers doesn't need to be part of the deal.
There is no moral equivalency between the minimum wage, which affects hundreds of thousands of low-paid workers in this state, and raising the wages of very affluent people. There is simply no equivalency.
Base pay for lawmakers is $79,500 a year, which Smith says is a sum that could be considered affluent. Many legislators receive additional stipends of several thousand dollars for committee and leadership posts. Someone making the minimum wage makes around $15,000 a year. The advocates say if the special session does not occur, then they would like to see the minimum wage raised early in the new year. They are also asking for $10 million more dollars in the state budget. It would help fund the hundreds of food pantries and soup kitchens in the state, patronized by around 3 million New Yorkers. They say there's been an 11% increase in demand since last year. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Our political observer, Dr. Alan Chertok, joining us on the line. Alan, you know, we were just talking yesterday about the possibility of a minimum wage hike and a legislative pay raise, and now we're hearing the special session to deal with these issues is looking like it's derailed because of Hurricane Sandy. No decision on who is in control of the Senate. What do you make of these latest developments?
Well, I can tell you one thing. These legislators are not going to like it. I'm suggesting to you that the reason this is happening is that the last thing Andrew Cuomo, the governor, needs now is a millstone hanging around his neck, to wit, he gave a pay raise to legislators at a time when New York is in such chaos. I think he recognized it. I think he's smart to recognize it. And I can't believe that he has to trade anything for a pay raise. Look, the Republicans are in debt to Cuomo in a way that is just unbelievable. He saved them. He didn't veto the redistricting bill, which led to their almost winning, if not winning. If he wants a minimum wage pay raise, he's going to get it. The poor people of New York State who are toiling out there all the time. And if he says to Dean Skelos, give it to me, he'll get it. The Democrats in the Senate certainly will give it to him. So the idea that he needs a pay raise hanging around him, which will smell so badly to New Yorkers, is just ludicrous.
Alan, some rumblings this week from the folks on the pro-hydraulic fracturing side of things, complaining that it's taking too long and it looks like there'll be even more delays before a decision on whether to allow the process of natural gas drilling in New York. As you continue to watch this, what is your thinking?
Well, first of all, David, you cannot turn the television on without seeing the industry talking about how we need fracking in the United States. If it's not multi-million, it's more than that. And I can tell you right now, it is effective. You know, these have sweet-looking people coming on talking about how they would never frack unless it was safe. We can guarantee that. Look, the press is on to do this. The United States needs the energy. At least that's what we are being told. Move towards energy independence, and that is being emphasized. Nevertheless, you can't get around the fact that, A, New York State does not have enough inspectors to make sure any wells that go in are done right. Two, we hear horror stories from Pennsylvania, and they are one after another. So what we have is a large doubt left in people's minds as to whether the chemicals that are being used in fracking are going to hurt them, our citizens, and their children. And what society spoils its water? They can't get around that. But the push is on. You can be sure of it. They're trying to get this thing, this fracking thing through. It looked to me, at least in the beginning, like Andrew Cuomo wanted it. Now I think he understands how salient, how important it is for so many people. And he's trying his best to make it go away, but just taking his time. That's the right thing he should be doing.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chertok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Pro-environmental groups watching the PCB cleanup of the Hudson River are suggesting a modest change in 2013 cleanup plans. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
At the end of the third season of dredging PCB sediment out of the Hudson River, activists are generally pleased with the results. Manajo Green is environmental director for Hudson River Sloop Clearwater.
Cleanup to date has gotten better each of the 3 years that they've been dredging. They started in 2009, had a lot of problems that year, and then took a year off for a peer review. And when they resumed in 2011, they had a very good year. And this year, everything they've learned from year one, year two, was applied to year three. They had very high productivity, very little capping. A lot of the emissions into air have been controlled. It's not completely resolved, but a lot of improvement has been made. new equipment and additional unloading capability and additional skill have all led to a better cleanup and higher productivity.
But as GE heads toward the next phase of cleanup, Green cautions that there are PCBs existing outside the footprint that has been delineated for dredging.
Some of these are in the navigational channel. And that means that if they're not cleaned up, that cost and that work is going to fall to the Canal Corps. The Canal Corps should be able to work with General Electric in a mutually beneficial way so that the channel of the Hudson River gets cleaned out in a logical sequence with the dredging that is being done for environmental remediation.
The Canal Corporation did not return a call for comment. Green says PCBs covering some 137 acres outside the planned dredging area are highly contaminated.
In concentrations that we think, and others who have studied this, are going to delay the recovery of the river.
The environmentalists are asking for a more rigorous cleanup and are hoping to persuade General Electric to agree to a relatively minor amount of additional dredging.
All they have to do is reach the dredge arm a little bit further or move the dredge one small step to the east or west of where they're currently planning to dredge. And we would end up with a world-class cleanup.
GE spokesman Mark Behan says the EPA approves, oversees, and sets the criteria for the dredging.
Just last May, EPA reevaluated whether the dredging project should be expanded or changed in any way, and it considered the input of the environmental groups and then reaffirmed definitively that the current dredging project, as it was designed and ordered by EPA and as it's being conducted right now by GE, is meeting EPA's cleanup goals and is fully protective of human health and the environment.
Officials say dredging has boosted the local economy and brought hundreds of jobs to the Fort Edward, New York area. The project is said to be on track to be completed by fall 2016.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
California has debuted a new cap-and-trade program that auctions greenhouse gas pollution permits. While there has been a lot of attention regarding the California program, the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports there has been a similar program in place in the Northeast for several years.
The Associated Press characterized the California Cap-and-Trade Emissions Initiative as landmark. CBS called it the most wide-ranging of its kind in the nation. The website for an NBC station in San Diego claims California is the first state in the nation to try to lower greenhouse gas emissions via cap-and-trade and that it would be a national model. But a model program already exists. Since 2008, Northeast states have participated in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative to control carbon dioxide allowances. The Adirondack Council buys allowances during the quarterly auctions. Spokesman John Sheehan says the California and Northeast programs are similar.
It's very similar in its mechanism that it uses a cap and trade program for reducing carbon, but it's only one state, and of course the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative here in the East Coast is 10 separate states. One of the differences is that our program covers electric power plants only, and California is attempting a more economy-wide program at this point. They've also done something important in that they have set a minimum price for carbon allowances at $10. There is no minimum being set by the regional greenhouse gas governing body, and it's been down in the neighborhood of only a couple of bucks. California, they chose to set the minimum price, and I think that that is one way that we could have gone here, but not enough states agreed that should be the way it works.
ENE, Environment Northeast Director of Market Initiatives, Peter Shattuck.
I think Reggie served as both an example and a proof of concept for California. When the REGI program launched 3 years ago, greenhouse gas cap and trade programs had not been rolled out in the U.S. So the way REGI has been seamlessly incorporated into the Northeast economy and created real benefits for participating states, I think, helped pave the way for the California program. One of the great successes of REGI was selling off the right to pollute rather than giving away these allowances, which are basically permits to release a ton of greenhouse gas, instead of giving them away for free, the RGGI states decided to auction them off and reinvest the proceeds in energy efficiency, which has the multiple benefits of reducing consumers' electricity bills, and it also reduces greenhouse gas emissions.
John Sheehan says RGGI has set a tone and hopes the entire country will move to similar cap-and-trade programs.
California is improving on the model that is in place here in the Northeast in some ways, and I think that as we work to essentially get the rest of the states in between the Northeast and California to participate over time, that the program will change again. But hopefully it'll continue to progress toward a more efficient and effective way of controlling carbon.
ENE Environment Northeast reports that Quebec plans to launch a cap-and-trade program in 2013 and then link with California's economy-wide model in 2014.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. President Obama and 28 governors recently urged Congress to extend production tax credits currently due to expire at the end of the year. The Innovation Trail's Sarah Harris takes us to Marble River, a new wind farm in northern New York that's rushing to start producing energy before the deadline.
Jerry Miller's 300-acre backyard in Clinton is mostly wetlands, except for a giant wind turbine that went up about a week ago. It's less than a mile from the Canadian border and stands 492 feet tall.
Wow. So this thing is huge.
Yes.
Should we get out and go look at it?
You take a look.
Yeah.
We climb up a ladder and into the tower. We're standing inside this huge, echoey cylinder where the ceiling is a long way up. It's one of 70 new turbines that just went up at Marble River. The project expects to be producing energy well before January 1st.
I say it benefits everybody in the town because it really lowered the town tax rate.
Jerry says that as long as the turbine is up and running, he gets paid around $15,000 a year by EDP Renewables, the company that owns Marble River. I couldn't confirm that amount because of the company's confidentiality policy, but it sure seems like a lot of money in Clinton, where the median household income is less than $30,000.
The thing is, like in this town, we're losing everything, you know. The church, the priest that was here had died, and now it's closed, and now the Canadian custom, that closed about a year and a half ago. You know, at one time there used to be businesses here, and that's all gone.
Jerry says the new wind project has given Clinton a much-needed boost. But new projects like Marble River may not be as feasible if the production tax credits, or PTCs, expire at the end of the year. PTCs give developers 2.2 cents off their federal taxes for every kilowatt hour of energy produced. It's helped the wind industry grow, and is one of the reasons it's expanded in the North Country over the past decade. Roby Roberts is the government liaison with EDP Renewables.
The bad news is really for new projects, because without some sort of policy signal about where the U.S. market's going to be and how you're going to price your product, and so you just force the entire industry off the cliff.
Typically, we've seen up to, you know, an 80% reduction in wind development when the PTC has been dropped. You know, a developer may have already signed some leases, but they will essentially, you know, they'll put everything in kind of hibernation mode until the subsidy comes back.
That's Professor Stephen Bird. He teaches energy policy at Clarkson University and says the production tax credit is subject to a boom and bust cycle. But it's not totally clear what will happen in the North Country if the PTCs expire. There aren't any turbine manufacturers in the region, and wind farms provide only a handful of long-term jobs. Professor Martin Heinzelman, also at Clarkson, recently conducted a study of three North Country counties with wind farms. He concluded that having a wind turbine on your land can result in a decline in property values.
It's not clear to us at this point whether wind energy in the North Country is indeed a net positive or net negative for the local residents.
In other parts of the country, a slowdown in the wind industry has serious repercussions. Vestas, the largest wind turbine manufacturer in the world, has already reduced its workforce in the U.S. and Canada by 20%. Back in Clinton, Jerry Miller still has hope for the industry.
It's helped the town a lot, and I think in the future, I think they're going to be able to do a lot more.
But until Congress decides what will happen to the production tax credit, that future remains uncertain. In Clinton, I'm Sarah Harris for the Innovation Trail.
Support for the Innovation Trail comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Innovation Trail is a collaboration between five upstate public media outlets reporting about New York's innovation economy. You can hear more at innovationtrail.org. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies of the program are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1247. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gostina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.